So I beg your permission and blessings to try to speak something on Srimad Bhagavatam that is worthwhile and bona fide. I'll also try to say something about the appearance of Lord Vamanadev, since it is Sri Vamanadev Dwadashi today. I didn't prepare much because I was just given this verse, and also the appearance of Sri Jiva Goswami. So I'll try to. Actually, this chapter is called. We're starting a new chapter, chapter 13 of Canto 8 of the Srimad Bhagavatam, and it's called Description of Future Manus. And it's mostly just a list of the names of the Manus, the 14 Manus. And there's one or two small purports. But it's leading up to, well, the next chapter is called The System of Universal Management. And then it starts on how pastime of Bali Maharaj and Vamanadev appearing. So I'll try to weave together these three different strands. And I'm actually going to. There's one class which is available, which I can recommend to everybody to listen to. It's called The Importance of the Bhagavat Worldview. It's given by a devotee called Chaitanya Charan Prabhu, who's based in India, Maharashtra, and is actually a member of the Shastric Advisory Council. And he gave a wonderful class back in March of 2010. Which was given this title of The Importance of the Bhagavat Worldview. And it was on these 11 verses, actually, which we're going to discuss today. I'll try to draw quite a bit of material from his class there. And I would recommend it. You can find it on ISKCON Desire Tree, 7th of March, if you go to Chalpati. And you go to the 7th of March, 2010, you can listen to the whole thing. It's about an hour long, so I won't be able to cover every point that he covers, but there's a lot of really wonderful points he makes there, and it's really worth listening to that class. But before we get to chanting verse 11, which is on the board, I'll read the description, the summary of the chapter, and the English of the verses 1 to 10. So the summary of the chapter says, of the 14 Manus, 6 Manus have already been described. Now, this chapter will consecutively describe each Manu from the 7th to the 14th. The 7th Manu, who is the son of Vibhaswan, is known as Shraddhadev. He has 10 sons named Ikshvaku, Nabaga, Drishta, Saryati, Narishyanta, Nabaga, Dishta, Tarusha, Prashadra, and Vasuman. In this Manvantara, or reign of Manu, among the demigods are the Adityas, Vasus, Rudras, Vishvadevas, Maruts, Ashvini Kumaras, and Ribhus. The king of heaven, Indra, is known as Purandara, and the 7 sages are known as Kashyapa, Atri, Vashishta, Vishvamitra, Gotama, Jamadagni, and Bharadvaj. During this period of Manu, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Vishnu, appears from the womb of Aditi in his incarnation as the son of Kashyapa. In the period of the 8th Manu, the Manu is Sarvani. His sons are headed by Nirmoka, and among the demigods are the Sutapas, Bali, the son of Virochan, is Indra. Bali, the son of Virochan, is Indra, and Galava and Parashuram are among the 7 sages. In this age of Manu, the incarnation of the Supreme Personality of Godhead appears as Sarvabhauma, the son of Devaguhya and Saraswati. In the period of the 9th Manu, the Manu is Daksha Sarvani. His sons are headed by Bhutaketu, and among the demigods are the Marichi Garbhas. Adbhuta is Indra, and among the seven sages is Dyutiman. In this period of Manu, the incarnation Rishabha is born of Ayushman and Ambudhara. In the period of the tenth Manu, the Manu is Brahma Sarvani. Among his sons is Burishena, and the seven sages are Havishman and others. Among the demigods are the Suvasanas, and Shambhu is Indra. The incarnation in this period of Manu is Vishvaksena, who is a friend of Shambhu, and who is born from the womb of Vishuchi in the house of a Brahmana named Vishvarashta. In the period of the 11th Manu, the Manu is Dharma Sarvani, who has 10 sons, headed by Satyadharma. Among the demigods are the Vihangamas. Indra is known as Vaidrita, and the seven sages are Aruna and others. In this Manvantara, the incarnation is Dharma Setu, who is born of Vaidrita and Aryaka. In the period of the 12th Manu, the Manu is Rudra Sarvani, whose sons are headed by Devavan. The demigods are the Haritas and others. Indra is Ritadharma, and the seven sages are Tapomurti and others. The incarnation in this Manvantara is Sudharma or Svadharma, who is born from the womb of Sunrita. His father's name is Satyasaha. In the period of the 13th Manu, the Manu is Deva Sarvani. Among his sons is Chitrasena. The demigods are the Sukarmas and others. Indra is Devaspati, and Nirmoka is among the sages. The Manvantara avatar is Yogeshwara, who is born of Devahotra and Brihati. In the period of the 14th Manu, the Manu is Indra Sarvani. Among his sons are Uru and Gambira. The demigods are the Pavitras and others. Indra is Suchi, and among the sages are Agni and Bahu. The incarnation of this Manvantara is known as Brihadbanu. He is born of Satrayana from the womb of Vitana. The total duration of the periods ruled by these Manus is calculated to be 1,000 Chatur Yugas, or 4,300,000 times 1,000 years. So, a lot of names there. So I'll just read the translations. Shukadev Goswami said, "The present Manu, who is named Shraddhadev, is the son of Vivasvan, the predominating deity on the sun planet. Shraddhadev is the seventh Manu. Now please hear from me as I describe his sons. O King Parikshit, among the 10 sons of Manu are Ikshvaku, Nabaga, Drishta, Saryati, Narishyanta, and Nabaga. The seventh son is known as Dishta. Then come Tarusha and Prishadra, and the tenth son is known as Vasuman. In this Manvantara, O King, the Adityas, the Vasus, the Rudras, the Vishvadevas, the Maruts, the two Ashvini Kumara brothers, and the Ribhus are the demigods. Their head king, Indra, is Purandara. Kashyapa, Atri, Vashishta, Vishvamitra, Gotama, Jamadagni, and Bharadvaj are known as the seven sages. In this Manvantara, the Supreme Personality of Godhead appeared as the youngest of all the Adityas, known as Vamana, the dwarf. His father was Kashyapa, and his mother Aditi. I have briefly explained to you the position of the seven Manus. I shall now describe the future Manus, along with the incarnation of Lord Vishnu. O King, I have previously described in the sixth canto the two daughters of Vishvakarma named Sangya and Chaya, who were the first two wives of Vivasvan. It is said that the sun god had a third wife named Vadava. Of the three wives, the wife named Sangya had three children, Yama, Yami, and Shraddhadev. Now let me describe the children of Chaya. Chaya had a son named Sarvani and a daughter named Tapati, who later became the wife of King Samvarana. Chaya's third child is known as Shanaishchara, Saturn. Vadava gave birth to two sons, namely the Ashwini brothers. So we come to this verse here. Translation and purport by His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami, Srila Prabhupada Ki Jaya. Translation. O King, when the period of the eighth Manu arrives, Saravani will become the Manu. Nirmoka and Virajaska will be among his sons. Purport by Srila Prabhupada. The present reign is that of Vaivasvata Manu. According to astronomical calculations, we are now in the 28th yuga of Vaivasvata Manu. Each Manu lives for 71 yugas, and 14 such Manus rule in one day of Lord Brahma. We are now in the period of Vaivasvata Manu, the 7th Manu, and the 8th Manu will come into existence after many millions of years. But Shukadev Goswami, having heard from authorities, foretells that the 8th Manu will be Sarvani, and that Nirmoka and Virajaska will be among his sons. Shastra can foretell what will happen millions and millions of years in the future. Om Agyan Timirandasya Kenanjana Shalakaya Chakshu Militam Jena Tasmai Shri Gunave Namaha Vansha Kalpa Trubhyascha Kripa Sindhu Bhyevacha Patitanam Pavanebhyo Vaishnavebhyo Namo Namaha Jai Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadadha Srivasari Gaura Bhaktavrinda Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. Ashtamantara Ayate, Sarvani Bhavita Manu, Nirmoka Virajaskadya, Sarvani Tanaya Nripa. O King, when the period of the 8th Manu arrives, Sarvani will become the Manu. Nirmoka and Virajaska will be among his sons. So, we're hearing about things which we don't learn at school. There's no question of mundane knowledge telling us about things that will happen millions of years in the future. So Shastra is telling us what, not only what has happened in the very distant past, and of course mundane knowledge doesn't go back very far. It goes back maybe 5,000 years or even less, actually, I think, probably. Even archaeological knowledge is very limited. So Shastra tells us what happens in the past and what is happening now and what will happen millions and millions of years in the future, Srila Prabhupada says. So for many it's quite a leap of faith to think that actually we can know such things millions of years in the future. So therefore, we have to really understand the whole context of the Srimad Bhagavatam and the Vedic teachings. So in that context, as I explained before, there's a wonderful class given by this devotee called Chaitanya Charan Prabhu, and he explains how there are different world views. I'm going to refer to my notes because some of it's a little complicated. So, first of all, we're hearing a lot of names here. So, the whole universe, the whole of creation is full of different living entities on various levels or hierarchies of life. And the universe is being administered, because the next chapter is universal administration. The system of universal management. So there is a system. There is a system at work, and that's what the Bhagavat worldview is all about. There is a system. There are these Manus, and the next chapter will explain what the purpose of the Manus is. But briefly, it's to re-establish the religious principles under the direction of, because we heard in the in the introduction, the summary of this chapter, we heard that there are quite a number of incarnations of Krishna are mentioned. One of being, of course, Vamanadeva, who we're going to hear a lot about over in the next few chapters of this eighth canto. So the universe is very carefully administered by various devatas, living beings, in at various levels in the universe. So there are four points to discuss. Actually, does a world view really matter? Because different people look at the world in different ways. And then, secondly, I'll try to briefly talk about the different predominant worldviews, and we'll compare them. And then, there are different criticisms and challenges of the Bhagavat worldview. And then, finally, and perhaps most importantly, how can we imbibe this Bhagavat worldview in our own lives at a deeper level? So, when Srila Prabhupada met John Lennon and Yoko Ono, I don't know if it was here, it was probably in this country. Tittenhurst Park, yeah, that's right, you're right, probably it was there. Which is not that far away, I don't think. The first question he asked them was, well, what philosophy do you follow? And they replied very typically for most people who are not devotees or kind of philosophically inclined. They said, actually, we don't follow any philosophy, we just live. A philosophy is just to live. But most people, actually, in the same way, they don't really think so much about life and the deeper questions of life. They just live from day to day, working and sleeping and having families and trying to enjoy themselves. But even if we say we just live, we are actually, without our conscious choice, actually living by some philosophy. Even if we don't contemplate or make any decisions about how you want to live your life, actually you're accepting the worldview that is prevalent in society. Because we have to live by some kind of philosophy. We have some view anyway of how things work, and therefore how we should conduct ourselves. So everybody actually does have a philosophy. Some philosophies may be philosophies or sophistry, word jugglery, but everybody does have a worldview. So some people say, what difference does it make if you believe in God or not? You're going to die, and we're going to die, just the same. So they'll then say, but you're following so many rules and regulations and restricting yourself so much. So what's the use? Ultimately, you're just going to you're just going to die anyway, just like I'm going to die. So what is the use? So in the 11th chapter of Bhagavad Gita, in the universal form, the Vishwarup Darshan that Arjuna has, he has a remarkable vision of all the soldiers, all the combatants in the Battle of Kurukshetra entering into the mouth of the universal form. And he sees actually that everybody's entering, not only the opposing side, but also his own people. In fact, the only ones who are going to be spared are Arjuna himself and his brothers, maybe one or two others also were spared. But everybody. So even the evil and the good, they're dying. But there are two analogies given in that chapter, the 29th text of chapter 11. And one is of rivers entering into the ocean, and the other is of moths entering into a fire. So, Baladev Vidyabhushan says that these analogies have a significance. A moth enters into the fire by its conscious choice, whereas a river goes into the ocean by its natural flow. So when a moth enters into a fire, it loses its life. It's a living creature with form and life, and it's reduced to ashes. But when a river enters into an ocean, the river's elements continue to exist. The water continues to exist in the ocean. So they're both entering into the ocean. They're both basically not entering the ocean. They're both coming. Their existence is coming to an end, a separate existence in one sense. But there's a big difference between the two. The moth, when it enters into the fire, it isn't doing any good, either for itself or anybody else. In fact, it doesn't even actually enter into the fire. It just gets singed, falls down, and dies. So it does no good. But a river is flowing originally from the mountains down into the plateaus, the plains, the valleys, and then into the sea. And it does so much good on the way, because it's providing water for all the fields, for growing crops, and for so many living entities, thirsty living entities, people, and so forth. And it's bringing down silt from the mountains, which is providing so much good soil. And then eventually it enters into the ocean, and then it's not destroyed. So it's described like, actually, those who don't follow the path of the Bhagavat view, or the path of the Vedas, they're just like moths, actually. They try to approach the fire, but then they just fall down and die without doing any good to themselves or others. Whereas the devotees of the Lord, they, during their lives, they lead such a life that they do so much good, not only for themselves, but for so many others, for society and the world as a whole, that, and then at the end of the life, actually, they can enter into the spiritual realm. They can enter into Goloka, like that. So these are the two differences. So it does matter, actually, our worldview. Because if we just follow the prevailing worldview, Jai Shri Shri Radha Gokula Nanda Ki Jai, Shri Shri Sita Ram Lakshman Hanuman Ki Jai, Shri Shri Gauri Tai Ki Jai, Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai. Then we're doing no good to ourselves or anybody else. But if we follow Krishna consciousness, then we're doing good for ourselves and the world. And eventually, after this body is finished, then we can go back home, back to the spiritual world. So, what are the predominant worldviews currently? So, there is the scientific, atheistic, materialistic worldview, the impersonalistic monistic view predominant in Hinduism and the monotheistic view in religions like Judaism, Christianity and Islam. So those three. So I'll have to very briefly, it's discussed at great length by Chaitanya Charan, so I recommend you listen to it, but it's very, so I'll just have to briefly cover it. So we'll start off with the scientific materialistic worldview. Of course, not every scientist is atheistic, but the prevailing, I don't know, perhaps dear Professor Bhaskar can confirm later or not whether it's true that the prevailing scientific view is materialistic. Basically, science, even science, is monism, because it means that only one substance is existing, that matter, basically, because mono means one. So there are spiritual monists and there are material monists. So in Devamrita Swami's book, Discovering Vedic India, he calls them devotees of matter, because they don't see anything beyond matter. So there's two arguments we use, which is the design argument and the law argument. The design, because we see that this universe is created so intricately, systematically, and delicately and coordinated and harmonized. So how does this happen? So we have the argument that because there is a design, there must be a designer. But there's also another argument, which is about law. If you have law, there must be a lawmaker. Now, it's interesting because he says in his class, Chaitanya Charan Prabhu, that actually the argument of the law and the lawmaker can undermine the design argument, the design and the designer argument. And the reason for that is that if everything works just by law, then you may have a creator, but he doesn't necessarily have to, he just sets the laws in motion. He doesn't necessarily have to be also the controller, because laws are just acting. So in actual fact, when Darwin came along, he said that actually you don't need either. Actually, they've all just evolved. You neither need the lawmaker nor do you need the designer, because evolution just evolves everything. Anyway, there's quite a lot of different material concerning that, which I haven't got time to go into, actually, unfortunately. There's some discussion about Newton, who actually was a religious person, and he said that his greatest achievement in life was remaining celibate throughout his life. And actually, he finished his life in a monastery as a monk, more or less. So, just skipping through. Yeah, one interesting point is that when the material scientists come to the question of consciousness, they start thinking, how can consciousness come from matter? Because they're devotees of matter. So they're thinking, therefore they can't see anything beyond matter. So they're thinking, how does consciousness come from matter? So this is like somebody who's always been in the dark, and they're stumbling around in the dark, knocking things over, bumping into things and people, and then suddenly they see some light, and then they ask, wow, how did the darkness produce this light? Like that. So, but of course we know that actually darkness is just an absence of light. So the point about the material, scientific material point of view, world view, is that it's actually it explains quite a lot, but it doesn't go far enough because it stops as soon as it comes to the limits of matter. It stops. Therefore, you know, it can't understand anything beyond matter. So, science has had tremendous success, but it's very lopsided, partial success. We understand matter, or the scientists understand matter to some degree, but consciousness not at all. So, it's explained that actually science developed not so much because science could explain things, but because religion at that time could not explain things. So this brings us actually to the next point, which was that Jesus, if we talk about Christianity, Jesus taught in the New Testament mostly parables and moral codes. So he didn't actually give very much factual information about, you know, the creation, about God even, just that he's our Father, like that. So therefore, intelligent people find it difficult to accept because it's incomplete. It's incomplete knowledge. One example given is that, for instance, theologians for hundreds of years, Christian theologians, have been trying to define the word eternal. So they're saying, because they think, many of them think, that actually life comes into being when the child is conceived. But then it's eternal after that. But how can you have eternity where there's a beginning? Either you can't have a sort of... you can't have it both ways. It either has no beginning and no end, or it has a beginning and has an end. But so they're saying that. So... and an interesting explanation was given by this devotee, that he was in a train debating with one Christian, and got onto the subject of abortion. And because the Christian says, well, why are you so worried about animals? What about the unborn children who are being killed, or people who are being killed? And so he says, oh, well, what happens to the, Chaitanya Charitamrita says, what happens to the child that is aborted in the womb? Does it go back to God, or does it actually have to go to hell? Because their philosophy basically is that if you accept Jesus as your savior, then you'll go to God, you'll go to him, you'll go to heaven. But if you don't, then you go to hell. So what happens to the child in the womb that hasn't had a chance to do that? So the Christian he was debating with said, well, the child has done no wrong, so it'll go back to Jesus, back to God. So then he says, well, in that case, wouldn't it be best if everybody was aborted? Because then they just go straight back to God. He says, oh no, that's not good. So in this way, the philosophy is incomplete, and therefore people have a problem. So then, to get on to the impersonalistic, monistic worldview, which basically comes from Shankaracharya, which is common in India, So, the interesting point about this is, because the impersonal point of view doesn't give the higher taste, it's like Srila Prabhupada said actually, that sometimes the impersonalists, they will, when they get bored with their impersonalism, their jnana, they will worship Krishna just for a change. Like that. Radha and Krishna, just for a change. But they don't really have the higher taste. So the problem with it is because it doesn't give the higher taste, it invokes, because we always have to get some taste out of life, that therefore we become attached to the lower taste. So he's explaining how in India there's such a predominance of religion, but at the same time people are very materialistic. They want money, they want wealth, they want prestige, they want position. Like that. And that's because of impersonalism, and that's why Srila Prabhupada was so strongly against it. Because it seems to be like religion, but because there's no higher taste there, people are becoming more materialistic. Because we have to get some juice, some taste, and therefore we go for the lower taste. So that's why. So that's the main problem with that. There's a lot more which I'm unable to get into here. So it's very problematical, the Mayavad point of view. It means that God just becomes a factor to help us to enjoy our material life better. So, to come to the Bhagavat worldview, a few interesting points he brings out here is that the Bhagavat worldview is monotheistic, but not just monotheistic. He says, there is one God, but he has many, many assistants. So that's what we're talking about here. The many Manus. So many, actually. So many Devatas. I don't know, 33 million, 33 crore, whatever it is. Laksh. But he says actually Krishna is so merciful that he allows for alternatives. If we are not ready to surrender to Krishna directly, personally, then he gives alternatives. So that's the broad nature of. So although it is monotheistic, if somebody's not ready, so Krishna's so kind in that way and so forbearing, because it's like if somebody was a owner of a business or the CEO of a big multinational company or something, and somebody else comes in and starts glorifying other people in front of the owner or the CEO, saying, oh yes, you're the CEO, some dog's body or something, oh you're the CEO and everything, you're so wonderful that, you know, but Krishna allows it. He allows somebody to glorify others other than himself, just so that they can be elevated. So that was one interesting point. And another important point is God's achinta shakti. And actually, this pastime of Vamanadeva appearing is one instance where we have to understand Krishna's achintya shakti. And those who have a limited material point of view may find it difficult to accept that God can appear, first of all, as a small dwarf, and then he can expand himself and cover the whole of creation in three steps. Like that. So it's very important that we understand. So there's many nice arguments. One of which is Jiva Goswami. I just have to mention his name. I'm run out of time really. But in his Krishna Sandarbha, he describes God's achinta shakti. He says it means that if God is supreme, he has to be superior to our intelligence. So therefore, we cannot understand Krishna fully. Because if we could encompass Krishna within our limited intelligence, then it means he's limited. So we can't possibly understand him fully. So then some might say, well, why bother thinking about God or Krishna? You can't possibly understand him. But by thinking about Krishna, we become purified and elevated. So it's actually very important. So and we can understand him enough to learn how to love Krishna. And that's the most important thing. A nice saying is that the problem with this world is that the foolish are confident and the wise are doubtful. So the foolish materialistic people think, yes, we can do anything we like. But devotees, sometimes we're doubtful. We say, actually, does God really appear as a dwarf and, you know, cover the universe with three steps? So I'll just have to very quickly round up, although I've missed out most of of the material I have here, is that the essence of the Bhagavad worldview is that we can develop a relationship with Krishna, with God, and we can have that personal relationship with him. And then there's three aspects discussed about how we can deepen our relationship with Krishna. Secondly, how we can intensify our relationship with Krishna, and how we can expand our relationship with Krishna. So deepening means in terms of philosophical conviction, in terms of realization and faith. And often our doubts are caused by the fact that we may have been chanting or following Krishna consciousness for so long, but unfortunately sometimes we're still agitated by material desires. So there's some very nice arguments given in this class I was listening to about how we can actually put into perspective. The main argument he gives actually is that actually we have transcended so many. Like, for instance, the example he gives is meat eating. How many of us were eating meat before we became devotees or came to Krishna consciousness? But now, if we're in a train or a plane and somebody's next to us is eating meat, how many of us are tempted? Hardly anybody. You know, it's tempted. So that means that we have actually been purified. But there are other more subtle material desires which are maybe more difficult to deal with. So that's a whole other discussion which I had to leave. But basically we have to get the higher taste. And that comes from dissociating with devotees who are fixed in that higher taste. And the more that we free ourselves from the lower taste, the more that we open ourselves to that higher taste. So we have to intensify our relationship with Krishna, and that means more in terms of our emotions, the strength of our emotions, our love. And the example is given of we've all got a mental home. So that means, you know, like if we go out from home to work or to distribute books or whatever, we always come back home, and that's where we rest. So, but we have a mental home. And that mental is where do we always go back to when we need rest and rejuvenation? So for a pure devotee, we go actually back to the we go to the lotus feet of Krishna. So we have to come to that point. So the way to do that basically is through absorption. Jayadvaita Swami was once asked in Pune, how can we become serious in Krishna consciousness? He said, somehow or other. So the point is, if you like one particular aspect of Krishna consciousness, then you focus on that. You develop that very seriously and sincerely. And then that will help you to gain taste for other aspects of it. And then finally, it's expanding our relationship with Krishna. So expanding means that that comes by preaching Krishna consciousness. The more we give Krishna to others, the more Krishna gives himself to us. So I'll have to finish there, unfortunately. There's a lot that I left out, but I would definitely recommend you listen to actually this wonderful class given by Chaitanya Charan Prabhu, which I've drawn from, and you'll find it very inspiring and fortifying to our Krishna consciousness. So give 2 minutes for any questions or comments.